Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's give a big thank you to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
What?
Keep them all in check. Shut up, Busta Rhymes.
What did he say? I got the something on the something and the something on your neck?
Yeah.
I just remember the neck.
Yeah. For years, I thought, I heard that song. You guys know I love hip hop. And for years, I thought he was saying, I've got the eggnog beep that makes you sweat your neck. Hoo ha. I've got you all in check. And I was like, man, New York slang is crazy.
The eggnog beats, man. It's the eggnog beats.
Like, what
dude.
Does that mean? I thought
Bro,
also.
It means you. That's actually quite good. I beat like eggnog because you got to beat them eggs to make that nog.
Oh,
pretty
man,
good.
That's
you gotta
pretty
beat
great.
Them eggs to get that nog sounds so absolutely dirty. Like we're going to get flagged in our internal.
Oh, geez.
Not a chance.
Yeah, not
we're
a
wholesome.
Chance.
We only use whole eggs.
Okay, last it has nothing to do with today's episode. You guys, true story for a long time as well. I thought he was saying, I got you all in check, like the country of Chechnya,
yeah.
Like CZEH.
Yes.
And
I'm reading all of you in my mind in check at all times.
What is like, okay, Buster, if you're listening, man, we're big fans. I'm Ben Bullen. With me, as always, is the one and only, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Noel Brown. Noel, you want Buster on the show?
Oh, man, that's a big dude right there, man. Man, he got swole. He was always kind of swole, but he seems to have gotten swoller late in life.
Over time, yeah. And gosh, you can't mess with the rhymes. He's got a sort of secret sauce, we could say. Segue. Noel, you are on the road and I
sound a little hoarse, it's because it's early for me and my brain, because I've been on the West Coast long enough where I have finally adapted to West Coast brain, only to have to adapt back to East Coast brain immediately.
Yeah, so, we were talking off air and I was saying like, oh man, I've been there. The time zones are weird. But we have a continuing mission, which is to explore ridiculous history. And we want to start today's episode with a big thanks to a good friend of ours, Mr. Brenton Smith from Station 16.
Of course, Brenton. And by the way, a missive, dare we say a mandate, dare we say it is our charge to explore ridiculous history.
Yes. Yeah. Check this out, Noel. So you and I know Brenton, I would say, pretty well at this point. I was astonished to find that he actually listens to the show, Ridiculous
Always
History.
Always am. Every time I hear that anyone listens to the show, I'm astonished.
Right. Despite the fact that he has to hang out with us on a regular basis in person as we make a bunch of weird sketch comedy and other videos.
Sometimes with you wigged out and costumed out as George Washington traveling through time.
Hey, and you as the person who introduces that poor guy to things like virtual reality or escalators.
I'm the straight man in the sketch, right? No, but it's fun. If you haven't seen those, by the way, check out the Stuff They Don't Want You to Know social media channels of note, and you can see them. It's basically become an ongoing series. But Brenton, fond of fine whiskeys, ball caps, and apparently sauce history.
Yeah. So he asked us, he said, you guys, you know, I listen to the show and also I like what you're doing with these condiments, but why have you never talked about Worcestershire? Worcestershire.
See, that's going to become an ongoing thing. I mean, there's just so many ways to make a meal out of that. Sometimes I like to go Worcestershire.
You know? There we go. Yeah.
Sometimes I like to shorten it to Worcester because we know how that goes.
We do. Yeah.
What is it though, Ben? What is this brown juice of the gods?
Hang on, I'm writing down the number of times that we're saying this name. Okay, so we're already at like 4 or 5. Yeah. So most of us who enjoy cooking will use this sauce, Worcestershire. And we often, at least here in the US and probably in England, we often buy it in a grocery store with like a paper wrapping around it, mm-hmm. the Liam Perrins bottle. Yeah, you remember those?
You know, it's true, Ben. And I've got to say, in my mind, Lee and Perrins is the only one that exists, though I know there are other pretenders to the throne.
And it's a very interesting throne indeed, because most all of us are familiar with the sauce, know it and love it. But if we just straight up describe the ingredients and the flavor, it would make even the most articulate person sound absolutely bonkers. Luckily, we are not the most articulate people.
Well, we're articulately bonkers, at the very least.
I love
it. Yeah, it is a weird one, right? Because there's nothing else quite like it. It has some soy sauce vibes, you know? It has some, if you've ever had like liquid aminos, you know, yeah. something like that. Or even, what's the other one? MSG kind of vibes. But yet none of those things and all of those things. It's a sort of a mystical brown liquid.
Yeah, it's still not quite... All the stuff we described is like part of Worcestershire, but not quite the thing entire. So look, we will throughout this episode use alternate pronunciations. You might hear Worcestershire, Worcestershire, or what'd you say? Worcestershire.
I liked Worcestershire, which I know is wrong, but it's just fun to say. It makes me like feel like I'm tasting it as I say it. You know?
Yeah, I like that. I like that form and function, just like Mo Rocca taught us. You know, folks, if you think the pronunciation is ridiculous, just wait till you hear the origin story. Before we get to that, though, we got to break down the flavor, man. How would you describe Worcestershire sauce?
Yeah, I was kind of beginning to, because I was trying to think of it. It's sort of like a state of mind more than it even is like a specific cool. flavor, right?
Like Florida, yeah.
yeah, because, I mean, it has the tang and the salt of something that we might recognize as like a soy sauce, but then it has the, it reveals these other almost sweet and sour, a tiny bit of subtle kind of floral notes or something. It really is just, what does it taste like? It tastes like Worcestershire.
Yeah. There's a citral brightness unexpectedly hidden.
That's the floral bit that I was trying to get to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are layers to it. And with so much going on palate wise, it's kind of surprising that we would put it in so many different dishes. I mean, we use it all the time.
Can we just start off the rip saying that I think we're all pretty big fans of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the time where we rag on Worcestershire sauce as a flavor. More just kind of maybe lampoon the history of it a little bit and kind of bring some things into the light. But boy, there's nothing like it. When that's what you want, there's nothing else you're going to reach for, whether it be a soup, a braise, perhaps even a sauté.
Yeah. Yeah, just so. And we want to go to Aaliyah Hoyt writing for How Stuff Works. She interviewed Seamus Mullen, chef at the Institute of Culinary Education, and he has one of the best descriptions of this. He says Worcestershire sauce is kind of a flavor amplifier.
Right.
It makes things deeper. It makes things more savory. It's like the hip kids call it umami.
Ooh, mommy. You know, it's true. And we love that. It really is sort of, what do they say? That's, there's like acid, heat, salt, and then there's umami, which is sort of like an additional, you know, taste sense almost, the way things hit your palate. It's mushrooms, you know. That's another thing about Worcestershire sauce. It really has a mushroomy kind of flavor to it as well, to me anyway. But yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. It's the fifth taste, right? Umami after salty, sweet, bitter, and sour. And I said acid, heat, and all of that. But those are kind of the chefy ways of describing those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Often umami is described as deliciousness. And Chef Mullen argues that umami brings out natural flavorings in food. So he says it makes steak taste more steak-like, mushrooms more mushroomy, you know? Oh, we've got to give a shout out to our friends Annie, Lauren, and Andrew over at Savor. Yeah, they've got a cool history of umami. It wasn't really a Western thing until the early 1900s, thanks to a an astonishing chemist and professor named Kikune Ikeda.
Something to do with MSG in that tale, I believe, right?
Yes, sir. You are correct. Yeah, yeah. And he isolated glutamate and created monosodium glutamate, MSG.
Which gets a bad rap, weirdly. We talked about this in our history of Chinese restaurants.
Yeah.
The MSG sort of got unfairly maligned in sort of a weird racist kind of slander campaign against Chinese restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he noticed, even back when he was popularizing this, he said, okay, what I'll call umami, it really is signaling, glutamate is signaling the presence of protein, and human beings evolved to hunt protein.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Even in the chefy type shows, they refer to the big old slab of, you know, main course, you know, goodness on your plate as your protein, whether it be, you know, beast or tofu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whether it be tofurkey or ribs. I mean, also, we were interested to learn you can taste glutamate, if you're a human, at concentrations 6 and 16 times lower than sugar or salt.
That is interesting. What does it taste like?
Just a dash will do it. It tastes delicious.
Yeah, okay. This is deliciousness we're still talking about here. Okay, got it. So without going too far into the food science of it all, if you want a deeper dive onto that kind of stuff, definitely please do check out Savor. We ought to point out that a lot of savory foods, which might be considered umami rich, they need time to steep in those flavors, you know, slow and low, you know, or a nice braise in its own juices of like a pork loin or whatever it might be. Those things have to really kind of set in, and that does take time and care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking with NPR, a flavor chemist named Ariel Johnson said a lot of umami-esque or umami-rich foods are fermented or slow cooked, like you said, like a bone broth or kimchi. And
which can take weeks for good kimchi. I mean, like for some of these things, right?
Yeah. You know, kimchi started by burying this stuff.
Totally. So,
so we'll see why this point about age is important, about fermentation, because we know there is ancient history. One of humanity's oldest condiments is garum, and it had umami before people used the word umami. It's a fermented fish sauce.
That's right. A precursor to ketsoup. Right?
Yes. Ketchup. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which later became ketchup. Yeah. And Worcestershire probably isn't a direct descendant of garum, but the flavor profiles have a lot in common. Fish sauces were a staple in East Asian cooking for millennia, basically.
I think a staple in both of our fridges as well, Ben.
Oh, yes, sir. Yeah. You gotta have your sauces.
You know, it's funny. I didn't think about this. Maybe it's been a while since we did the episode on ketchup, but Worcestershire sauce, as we know it today, really, really is kind of the next evolution of that garum that was considered to be the precursor to ketchup, but modern day ketchup doesn't resemble either of these things at all. But
not really,
Worcestershire sauce really is kind of that thing that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's carrying the torch. We don't know whether the original Worcestershire bros were trying to copy an existing variation, like if they had a sample of it. But our story starts with three guys. There are two of them, John Wheely Lee, spelled L-E-A, and William Henry Parents. They're chemists.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Lee and Parents. They started a business in 1823 in Okay. Would this be Worcester?
I think it's a Worcester. I think it's a Worcester.
Oh, it's, you know, it's one of those things where you've got Leicester, but it's spelled Leicester. We've talked about this in England. So would not it follow logically that Worcester would be Worcester?
It's English, man. There are no rules, really.
And why add the Shire on a place that already is the name of basically a Shire? Exactly. Why not just call it Worcester sauce?
Yeah.
Or Worcester sauce. Anyway, yeah. We'll probably get to that. But that's where they were operating, out of a little pharmacy on the High Street, which was Broad Street. And they made tons of stuff. They were doing lots of experimentations, many of which were with flavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They also went on to make a hair regrowth tonic. Spoiler.
I love that.
Spoiler. It doesn't work. But try it in soup. I don't know what to tell you. They also quite possibly create a fable about their own fabled sauce. So maybe.
Ooh, I love a good fable.
Yeah. Yeah. Metafable. So maybe we can share the origin story as they put it. And we'll learn about the third character in the tale.
I'm just going to nip this in the bud real quick, guys, and let's see what the internet says as to how we should pronounce the name of this sauce. Not going to change the way I pronounce it necessarily, but I'm just curious.
Oh, we've got some tangents on that too, man.
Okay, well, I'm excited to get to that. But it says here, Worcestershire. See, I can't even do it. Worcestershire. It's a woo. It really is woo-ha.
Worcestershire, and then sure.
Sure.
Worcestershire. So when you get to the end of it, you're just saying, yeah, sure. Yeah.
I like Worcestershire. I like doing a sure shire in there. But sure shire enough, huh?
There we go.
That was a transition right there. They did, in fact, you know, dabble in sorcery. Sort of what do you call it, Ben, when you transmute things into other things?
Alchemy.
Flavor alchemy.
There we go. I like that. I'm a flavor alchemist.
And they had, at least on the early versions of this this fabled sauce, a little bit of a tagline, right? How did that read?
Oh, they put out an ad shortly after they began selling the sauce.
It.
Yeah, and it says, quote, "The Worcestershire sauce is prepared by us from the favorite recipe of a nobleman of acknowledged gout," which back then was not a bad thing. Gout meant having good taste, taste.
Don't you get gout from eating too many rich foods?
Yes.
I love language. That's so fun. That's terrifying. Yeah. Too much potted meat from all that good taste and makes you have a foot swell up. And this was likely referring to the nobleman in question, Lord Marcus Sandys of the Third Baron Sandys, who had grown accustomed to kind of a garum-like fish sauce that he had learned about and kind of gotten a taste for while governing abroad in Bengal. I can see a real colonizer, this fellow, right?
Yeah, let's picture this moment with this story. So an aristocrat returns to England from abroad in colonial India, and he just cannot find his favorite condiment.
Can't find my favorite condiments.
Right, and Jesus. He doesn't have any physical samples, probably because he likes the stuff so much, he already ate it all. So So picture him like Rick Rubin in all these recording sessions. We can picture the Baron. He's waving his hands around. He's just throwing words out, and he's describing through speech and comparison alone his experience tasting fish sauce. And he might have been like, "Well, it's a little sweet."
"Oh, I see. So mayhaps molasses, my lord."
"Sort of, but also..."
I'm both Lee and Perrins.
"Sort of, but also sour."
"Ah, so tamarind then."
"I mean, perhaps, but it did have fish in it somewhere."
"Okay, we're going to need to workshop this one for a while, my lord."
Like, what? We have to exercise empathy with Lee and Perrins. They got this crazy rich dude who is like, "Let me just give you the vibes."
Yeah, there should be a tagline. It's "The rich, we get things done." Because, you know, they've got the money to throw around and the influence. And usually when they want a thing, people kind of listen. And that tends to, at times, only benefit the rich. But sometimes, Ben, sometimes you get the trickle down of sauce that benefits the world.
Here's my question. Was there any threats of hung, drawn, and quartered involved in this?
You never know.
You never know. History
is written by the victors, and these guys seem to have done well by themselves because their name still is emblazoned on the sauce.
Right. So they go back to this baron, and they say, "Okay, based on your somewhat unhinged conversation, we have taken all of the like flavor notes that you told us about. We put them into this weird sort of mixtape, and here you go. We're not sure exactly what they handed him, but the original thing probably had, well, do you want to just read the list of ingredients?
Yeah, and I'm not going to lie, Kevin. I initially saw this list, and I'm like, okay. You know, I mean, we don't have proportions here, but we've got barley malt vinegar, spirit vinegar, which I imagine is, but barley malt would be a darker vinegar. Spirit vinegar would be a little bit more of maybe a bitter, clear vinegar.
Yeah.
Molasses, you know, and sugar and salt, anchovies, tamarind extract, shallots, which were later replaced by onions, garlic. I hate this one, though, man. I hate spices.
It's
I find
so
that
vague.
To be so condescending. It's like, come on, man. Which ones? And also, of course, flavorings.
Even weirder. Probably like probably something citral. Probably like lemons of some sort, like lemon juice or.
I guess so, but why not just say lemon? Lemon, you said molasses. You said tamarind extract.
Spices,
give us the goods.
Flavory. Yeah.
No, it certainly is a proprietary formula, despite the fact that we do see other versions of it. But there's going to be pretty significant flavor differences. It's not exactly codified, right?
Oh,
this sounds
100%.
Like we both, I think, thought this sounds okay. That sounds, didn't get behind that, except for the, you know, obfuscation of the spices and flavorings. But apparently the first batch was quite bad.
Yeah, I was gonna say, who knows? It sounds eclectic, but maybe it tasted awesome. It did not spoil.
No,
this
I
stuff
know.
Was gross. And before we get to the plot holes in that official kind of origin story, we know for sure that Lee and Perrin's first crack at their fishy sauce in 1835 was a swing and a miss. Even the company itself later described that first pilot batch as completely unpalatable, but they had sunk cost fallacy. They spent so much time and money making barrels of this stuff that was basically wet garbage juice.
Wait, why would they have done that? Why wouldn't they have market tested it first before they made massive scale of it?
I mean, they were trying to do the thing where you have a problem and you keep adding to it, like in cooking. You know, it's much easier to add a flavor than it is to subtract a flavor.
Sure.
So I think they were just like, hey, maybe this is going to be the one. Maybe we need more molasses, or maybe we need more anchovies. It didn't work. And they didn't throw it away because they had a sunk cost. So instead, they took the barrels of this test condiment and they hid it away in the basement of their pharmacy and just sort of like washed their hands of it.
Wait a minute. This does sound a little apocryphal, but let me guess. We heard about this in a recent story, too, about a thing in maybe it was Rome. What was it, Ben? It was like some century men had some like some material they stuck away because they kind of forgot about it, and then it fermented, and it was really good. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I know what it was. I looked this up on my own. This was not a ridiculous history moment. It is a thing in Japan that is basically fermented soybeans, and it's called it looks like sticky, cheesy kind of beans.
Natto?
Natto, yeah. It was featured in that show, Shogun, where, like, these women are eating it, and they're kind of Blackmore, whatever the hell his name is. He asks what that is. He wants to try it, and they tell him it's not really for you. It's not something you'll be into. And he, you know, insists, and he eats it, and he's like, oh, this tastes like
diapers.
Spoiled cheese or something,
yeah.
Right? But that kind of thing where it's like, and they tucked it away. The story behind that was that there was some, you know, invading, you know, group of soldiers that had their soybeans stowed away and they forgot about them, or they let them basically, they wrapped them in some wet something or other, and then they fermented and became this natto, and the general or whatever got a taste for it. And next thing you know, this is a staple food of Japan.
I have eaten so many strange things. And I will say, I know this is sometimes a controversial opinion. Natto to me has always answered a question that I never thought to ask, which is like, have you ever smelled a diaper and thought,
right,
what if I could just eat that for breakfast?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Apparently, what's it? Durian tastes real nice, but smells like dirty diapers.
Yeah.
But, I hope I was sort of on the right track, Ben. What happened with these barrels of this concoction that they kind of shoved in the basement and forgot about?
You're absolutely on the right track. More than a year passed. It wasn't until at least 18 months later that someone opens the door, you know, to the basement of the pharmacy. They walk down the stairs and they see these barrels and they try the sauce one more time. Maybe they were thinking, I can finally throw it away. But lo and behold, this once wet garbage juice is now amazing. Like the fermentation fixed it.
You can't really plan for that. I mean, you can, but a lot of times it starts from these happy accidents, like with the natto, right? I mean, again, you would maybe argue that that was an unhappy accident, and that's totally fine. Yeah, but yeah. Some people do seem to really love it, whether it's a taste you develop or whatever. Even in Japan, I think there's like a percentage of the population that can't stand this stuff. But awesome, man. I'm really happy and really cool if true.
Really cool if true. You know, this is a world-changing condiment. It's definitely an England-changing condiment. You can put it on darn near everything. And let's be honest, not to be a negative Nelson, but British cuisine at the time could really use the help.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, again, apocryphal or not, it does take time, fermentation, whatever, whether it be braising or like long, slow cooks or actual fermentation, which is a chemical process to make flavors like what we're talking about, the umami type of flavor. But if you have a sauce like this, it almost gives you a shortcut.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And there also, Worcestershire is a runaway hit because people are buying a story as much as they're buying a sauce. There's this mysterious origin tale of a nobleman haunted by memories of this sauce from foreign shores. There's another mystery because the first consumers don't know what is in this. They just think it's tasty.
Mm-hmm.
That's a heck of a trust fall.
They don't care, you know, who cares, especially in those days. It certainly wasn't the era of I need, you know, listed ingredients and nutritional facts and calorie counting.
Government regulation.
Right. Of course, there was no Food and Drug Administration. Right. You know, we were coasting on a wing and a prayer and a tasty sauce.
We're just thankful that lady fingers don't have actual women's fingers in them.
That we know of.
That we know of. Up to a certain point, right. There's a percentage of fingers allowed. Anyway, yeah, you're absolutely right, dude. The ingredients of the original Liam Perrin's Worcestershire sauce, they were like the Coca-Cola secret recipe of the time. For decades, there was a bit of a conspiracy afoot because you can find a pharmacy catalog from their lab on Broad Street. It was dated to 1823. We knew that tamarind and anchovies were definitely in there, but it would take until like 2009 for the world to get a closer look at the actual story and the actual ingredients. And maybe that's where we go to the real story. Noel, I think we've teased it pretty well. How do we know that this barren sandy thing is maybe a little embellished?
Well, I'll tell you, Ben. We'll tell you, actually. We'll do it together, as always. There may have been a nobleman, you know, in the mix who was waving his arms around wildly and describing these flavors that he had savored back in his time abroad. But it probably wasn't the guy we described who was, what was his name again, Ben?
Sandy. Baron Sandy.
But it was the whole like, oh, Lord Marcus Sandy, the third Baron Sandys.
Yeah.
I don't even understand what that means. The third Baron of Sandys Press. Anyway, his name was Marcus Sandys. And we think it probably likely wasn't him. According to a memo written by Lee and Perrin's accountant and archivist, Brian Keough, in 1997, Lord Sandys apparently never governed in Bengal,
huh?
Or ever even traveled to India.
Oh! No!
Say it ain't so.
It remains a mystery then as to who actually was this apocryphal aristocrat who commissioned the first Worcestershire sauce. And a note here, we're getting a lot of the true story from our friends over at foodrepublic.com, an excellent article by Andrew Hausman called The Bizarre Story Behind the Invention of Worcestershire Sauce.
You could almost call him like a, what do you call it, a sauce patron. You know,
mm-hmm.
a patron of sauce instead of the arts.
A saucy of like Sousa Ray.
A benefactor. Exactly. Yes. A sauce benefactor. A Sousa. I love this. So we do have, of course, as is often the case in, you know, old stuff, competing versions of the story. In 1884, in the New York Times, a paper of note, it's been around for a long time, they claimed that Sandy's wife wanted Lee and Perrins to recreate a curry powder, which they then converted into sauce form rather than like a powder, which is, you know, basically just a blend of spices.
All right. So a mysterious aristocrat returning from abroad, or you're working with your colleague and you're like, hey, guy, I know we got other stuff to do, but my wife really wants this curry powder. Take it for what it is. We cannot argue with the results. Worcestershire rips, dude. It is amazing.
Oh, man. I mean, there's just nothing like it. Like I said, we're not here to be like an ad for Lee and Perrins, but when I want that certain flavor in my roast, I reach for Lee and Perrins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we mentioned 2009, right? So shout out again to the archivist, Brian Keough, who found notes dating back to the like mid-1800s that list different things they tried to add in those barrels. So like cloves, different vinegars, pickles, acetic acid.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Just that got the Campbell soup. Mm,
I love it. No, I just yum. Acetic acid. Peppers, essence of lemon. Some of these things probably are what would be under that catch-all of flavorings and there spices.
Yeah.
Those are some of the original ingredients. And, of course, this changed as the chemist evolved the recipe. But here's the thing. We talked about today at the top of the show how, in my mind, I think when I want that certain extra something, I reach for Lee and Perrins, because in my mind, that is the quintessential Worcestershire sauce. There's just nothing else like it that will quite do the trick for me. But I have certainly gotten alternatives in the past, and they're fine. And there might even be, you know, if you really thought about it, you could almost treat it like different hot sauces where, depending on which brand you go with, you might get a different little kick. I don't know, Ben, what's your experience been with non-Lee and Perrins Worcestershire's?
Pretty similar. You know, there are brown sauces that are a little bit heavier, like hybrids of, you know, H&P sauce is kind of, or HP sauce is kind of like a hybrid of Worcestershire and ketchup. But maybe it's the expectation or the nostalgia of Lee and Perrins, because I associate it with steakhouses. You know, I associate it with dashing it into crock pots and slow cooking and prime ribs and stuff like that. So I don't know. It's crazy because we've got to talk about these different varieties. We have mentioned this to each other a little bit off air. It turns out the reason Lee and Perrins is not monopolistic, they're actually owned by Kraft Heinz now, is that Worcestershire sauce became a generic term in 1876. The English High Court said, "You lot don't own a trademark for the name Worcestershire."
Absolutely not. Because for me, it's the name of a town. It's like Gene Simmons trying to trademark the rock and roll fingers. Like, you just can't, man.
He did try to do that, apparently.
Oh, wow. And it's just out in the ether at this point, guys. You can't. Can you trademark a song? Well, yes, you can, actually. Can you trademark a breeze? You know? No, you can't.
Yeah. I mean, we can collectively say Worcestershire, however you got here, we're glad you made it to the plate. You ridiculous, amazing sauce. One thing, we should mention the iconic like paper wrapping that comes from shipping to the U.S. In 1839. A family in New York, the Duncan family, starts importing this. And the problem was the bottles were breaking in transit on the ship.
Right.
So they wrapped it in that paper. And it's so iconic. You know, if you go to the grocery store today, you look at this monopoly of sauces, the one that's wrapped in paper is interesting, right? Again, like to the earlier point, there's something that feels almost secretive about it. Like you can't see this sauce.
Dude, and I'm sorry, it really does remind me, and not that you could like figure out a formula by gazing into the sauce, but there's a synthesizer company from Japan called Roland who made this really awesome analog synthesizer in the 80s called the Juno, and they notoriously would break because they took the circuits, the pieces that would actually made the sound, and they coated them in this polyurethane thing because they didn't want people to be able to see the circuit design coming across the assembly lines. They were worried about industrial espionage, but that ended up actually biting them in the butt because it caused the things to notoriously malfunction. So whenever you get one of those repaired, people will, you know, soak them in acetone and get rid of that that coating. So you're not wrong, Ben. That's really, really interesting in terms of.
Do you
of
have the, one of those? I swear.
I do.
I think
I do.
You mentioned yeah. it yeah. to it's me when great, you when you first got one. Does it work?
It does work. It works beautifully. And I got it serviced by a guy who did that very thing, literally took all the voice chips out and soaked them in acetone. And now it's, you know, like new. But Ben, I got to say, I was wondering about alternatives to Lee and Perrin. Yeah. I found a great article on the Daily Meal listing 13 best Worcestershire sauce brands that you can buy. And I had no idea. There's a couple, like one bourbon barrel aged one from Bourbon Barrel Foods that looks good. And there was one that's organic and vegan by Wizard, the company called Wizard.
Two very different data points on the spectrum of sauce.
Very much so. And then you've got Annie's, of course, which you'll maybe know from their expensive macaroni and cheese boxes.
Oh, right,
like
right,
bunnies.
Right.
Yeah. But the one that interested me the most, and I thought was really unusual, especially per our hot sauce conversation, Crystal, who makes that pure Louisiana hot sauce, they make a Worcestershire sauce.
Okay, I'm in.
I want to try all of them. I want to try them all. I really want to broaden my Worcestershire horizons.
For our buddy Brenton, Noel, what's the name of that bourbon Worcestershire again?
It is just called Bourbon Barrel Aged from Bourbon Barrel Foods. But if that one exists, I got to imagine there's like a niche kind of bespoke world of Worcestershire sauces, just like there is for hot sauce. But this one is literally just called Bourbon Barrel Aged by Bourbon Barrel Foods.
That's for you. That's for you, Mr. Smith. We also, it turns out we are not the only folks who have had fun trying to pronounce the name of this sauce. It was interesting to learn 2021, Lee and Perrin announced a marketing campaign called Speak Your Sauce. And ooh. So, yeah, the little paper that has the Lee and Perrin's Worcestershire sauce or whatever on there, they took out the word Worcestershire and they put in just a blank and air quotes or quotation marks because, you know, you're reading it, not speaking it. And they said that this was a limited edition. They said, with our Speak Your Sauce bottles, we're officially embracing the struggle and celebrating all the different pronunciations because any way you Worcestershire works for us. I don't love that they turned it into a verb, but whatever.
Speak your truth.
Yeah. Speak your sauce. Oh, boy. Yeah, I guess you're right. It must be a speak your truth thing. So you don't have to pronounce it any particular way. Most people these days will know what you mean. And I got to tell you guys, I am kind of pooped from saying Worcestershire over mm-hmm. and over again.
I shan't speak it again.
Counting this sentence, we have said the word Worcestershire well over 32 times.
Okay. I think that's respectable, frankly. I don't think we overdid it.
Do you guys want to hear my take on Worcestershire sauce?
Yeah.
I can't have it.
Because of the condition.
Yep.
Yeah.
The condition. Well, maybe we can tap the scientific community to make a condition safe version of this fabled sauce. And I had one more to add that I think Brenton would also like. There is a company called Bear and Burton's, and they make something called W sauce. And it looks like it comes in a couple of different varieties. One of them is like a traditional American Worcestershire, and the other one is called Fireshire, which would presumably be a spicy Worcestershire sauce. And it's apparently a very new brand during the middle of the global pandemic. Two fishermen, this also sounds apocryphal, named Bear and Burton, found themselves out of work with too much time on their hands. They began experimenting with Nana's W sauce, and the brand quickly took off.
So now our count has to change. Now we've said it well over 32 times. Worcestershire, Worcestershire. The word is haunting me, just like that mysterious sauce haunted some apocryphal British nobleman centuries ago. This stuff
you can also get it in powder form, by the way. We didn't put that out. You can get it like in a spice blend packet kind of form.
I love this stuff, man. I know you're on the road, but when you get back in our fair metropolis of Atlanta, we all got to get together. Let's go grab some food somewhere. Oh, every time absolutely. We do an episode, I get so hungry when we talk.
It's about almost
food.
Grilling time, buddy, and nothing goes with it. I mean, you know, we haven't even talked about steak sauce because that's such a catch-all, massive ball of wax there. But I like just a little bit of Worcestershire sauce. Add to the count with my steak.
Yeah.
As a condiment, not just as a cooking implement.
Yeah. It's like a little dipping. I like a little dipper.
A little jus.
A little au jus. And au revoir, folks. We're gonna
bless you.
Au revoir, folks. Gesundheit to you as well. We hope this finds you. Guten Tag.
And Auf Wiedersehen.
Yeah, and Auf Wiedersehen, yes. Big thanks to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Thanks to Alex Williams, who composes Bang and Bop. Thanks also to our pal, Brenton Smith. Brenton, we hope we did you proud.
Huge thanks to Alex Williams, who composed this theme. Christopher Asiotis, Eves Jeffcoats, here in spirit. The Quizster, the Puzzler. Man, I gotta say, I was eating at Cantor's Deli yesterday in Los Angeles, and I had a callback to a breakfast that AJ, the Puzzler, and I had at Barney Greengrass in the Upper West Side of New York, where we ordered a lox scrambled egg situation, and I tried it at Cantor's, and I asked AJ, it was pretty on point. It's pretty on point, but nothing can match the memory of eating that breakfast with you.
Shout out to AJ Bahamas Jacobs. If you're listening, AJ, be well aware, we might see you sooner than you think.
Yes. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.